Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. Marianne, I have the most beautiful book as the first thing that I want to talk about today. It's called Case Studies. It's written by Felicity Jones, who's a floral designer, and the photographs are by Mark Smith, who's a really first-class photographer.
Kia ora, Cousin Mark.
Yes, I know you have family connections, but I flogged the book.
Well, you get all the great art books, Maureen. Yes, that's your thing.
That is my thing, and this is a great art book. It's hard to describe it. You need to listen to the interview because it's about how plants were brought to New Zealand, how they went back to the UK generally, but it's about a whole lot more. It's about our ecology, it's about the future as well as the past, and all I can say is listen to the interview.
Fabulous. And then I'm speaking this week with Dr. Joe Cribb, who has published a book called Don't Worry About the Robots. Now, this is it was edited post-COVID, so written before COVID and then edited post-COVID, and it's a terrific book about it's actually not so much about AI. There's a marvellous chapter on AI, but it's a book about how we all need to become more fully human in the face of AI and in our work journeys to stay relevant, become more fully human. And it's a terrific read.
It sounds like it and so prescient. But first, we're going to start with Claudia from Scorpio. And we are going to talk about all the amazing events that are coming up. Boy, they have a packed schedule.
We are so lucky to have Scorpio in Ototahi.
Kia ora to Claudia from Scorpio, our wonderful sponsors. Boy, you have been packing in writers and events.
Yes, indeed. Yes, we have. Into a very tight bookshop at the moment.
Very tight. Lots of stock in,
lots
I bet.
Lots of stock. Yep. Get in there. We try and say every year, you know, you should really be thinking about your Christmas shopping now while we've got everything in good numbers. But do the people listen?
Never. Well, I've got a little list of what I want to read over the holidays.
I better
take heed of what you're saying.
Indeed,
Claudia.
Yes. Yep. While we still have plenty of stock. Shall we crack into it?
Yes, let's please.
Alrighty, so coming up are Scorpio-related events for the next few weeks. Wednesday the 12th, we're doing an off-site. Quite a cool off-site event at the Town Hall for Pub Choir. Have you heard about Pub Choir?
I have heard of Pub Choir.
Yeah, so Astrid Jorgensen is a Kiwi who I think lived in Australia and maybe also in the UK and runs Pub Choir, where she gets, you buy a ticket, you go along, you get organised into your vocal grouping, soprano, alto, tenor, and then you sing. You sing en masse with total strangers the songs that you really want to sing when you're at the pub. And it's supposed to be a hoot. She's written a memoir called Average at Best, which I love the sound of, and the deal with Pub Choir is that it, you know, it takes you as you are. You don't have to do any fancy training or anything like that.
And it sells out, I guess.
Yeah, thousands of tickets.
Yeah.
And Astrid's a big fan of indie bookshops, so she got in touch about us coming along to sell books, and she'll be there signing copies as well. So that should be lots of fun if you're interested in singing, and you don't have to be a good singer. That's not the idea.
No,
average
it's not.
Average at best.
Yep. Yes.
Yep.
Just sing your heart out.
Indeed. Hot off the press, exciting new news. Saturday 15th, Tusiata Avia is launching her new book of poetry, Giving Birth to My Father. You may know Tusiata as, well, she's going to be next year's writer in residence at the IIML. That's also recent news, very exciting for her. Also the author of The Savage Colonizer Handbook and The Show, and Big Fat Brown Bitch.
Wild Dogs Under My Skirt. Yes. I saw her when she first performed that. I can't tell you how long ago it was.
As a solo show?
Yeah, yeah. As a solo show. Mm. And you knew you were in the presence of greatness.
Indeed.
Back then.
So Twisty Art is going to be launching her new book at 5 p.m. on Saturday the 15th of November at Space Academy. It's free. Come along. I'll be there selling books. Twisty Art will do some readings. I'm sure there will be dancing. It's going to be a party. It's going to be lots of fun. And then that brings us into the next week. Tuesday the 18th, an in-store event, 5:30 kickoff for an author talk with Peter Dowling of Oratia Books and Takare Norton from the Kaitahu Archives. So Peter he's currently publishing a sort of like another edition of some earlier work by, is it C.W. Reed, I want to say?
Well, it used to be A.A. Reed.
Oh, my bad.
Back in the, but there were several Reeds. A.A. was the famous
A.W. Reed.
Yes.
A.W. Reed.
Yeah.
Peter has been working on a reissue of New Zealand place names, which I understand is like a sort of compendium of interesting names from across the country. And he's teamed up with Takare Norton to do a talk kind of inspired by this book's reissue, but also heavily influenced by Takare's work with the Ngāi Tahu Archive and the Kahuru Manu, the Ngāi Tahu Cultural Mapping Project. So I don't know, have you heard about this?
I have, and yeah. I've seen the map.
It's online, it's, yeah.
Quite fascinating. It's astounding. Yeah.
For those who don't know, that the Ngāi Tahu Archive have been working on this, you know, interactive digital map, which shows you all of the Māori names, the original names, for places all across Te Waipounamu. And I think it's been at Word. I remember once or twice they've done a talk.
That's where I've seen it. Yeah. And the number of names, how close they are on the map, just, you know, is astounding. Because it shows that Māori knew every inch of this.
Yeah, every valley, right? Yeah, yeah, every stand of cabbage trees.
Yeah, exactly.
Quite fascinating and very detailed. So that should be really interesting. If you're interested in cultural history, New Zealand history, tramping, all sorts. I can think of lots of reasons. And then the following week, we have a bit of a double whammy on Monday the 24th. And now, Morin, would you like to talk to Rangatiratanga and Gentlemanship?
I would, because this has been put together by somebody I know quite well, Grant Hodgson. This comes from his research into his family. There were some early missionaries, very early missionaries, who are part of his family. And it's a recreation, well, not a recreation, it's hard to explain. There's a conversation between Hongiheka and his followers and a group of missionaries. And Grant's forebear was the translator, or he was either the translator or he wrote down the transcription. I think he was the translator. And this conversation, Grant believes, holds a lot of clues about how Māori and Pākehā were relating to each other back in 1825.
Yeah, 1825.
Yeah, so he's going to be there. He's got Mike Grimshaw from the university to talk. I'm introducing them. And it's free, isn't it?
It's free, that's right.
And it's at the Arts Centre?
Yeah, in the Maker Workshop, which, for those who don't know, is in the same wing as Lumiere and the Paint and Sip on the sort of Rolleston Ave side. 12 p.m. kickoff.
Yeah, and it will be fascinating. And anybody who's interested in Māori Pākehā relationships from the very early days to right now, I think we'll find a lot of interest in this.
And on the same day, later that night, at 5:30 p.m. at Tūranga, we've had to change venues because this talk was in such high demand, Ben Pentreath is visiting from the UK. Ben Pentreath is a designer. He's known amongst Scorpio fans as the author of An English Vision, which is this fabulous Rizzoli-published hardback photographic kind of tome that we keep in our interiors department. So I understand Ben has some links to New Zealand, and he's coming out here and was interested in doing an author talk, and we said, oh, yes. And then promptly the RSVPs filled the shop, so we've moved it to a bigger venue, so the library are helping us out, so props to Tūranga and their team. So at 5:30 p.m. at Tūranga on Monday the 24th, you can hear an author talk from Ben Pentreath, and Vincent Holloway of Brooksfield. So Ben is the designer for Brooksfield. This talk's going to be very interesting. We'll get a bit into Ben's career, into his sort of principles and practice. I guess he's wonderfully successful. So maybe, you know, we'll learn
find
the secrets.
Secrets to success.
Yeah, that's right.
And put up Georgian houses all through Christchurch, Otatahi.
Indeed. And Ben will be signing books. We will be there selling books. You're also welcome to bring your own copies if you already have them. This book's been out for about a year, but Ben just hasn't been to New Zealand since it's come out. And we will have a few of his backlist as well. Yeah, it should be fascinating. And I will then push on to our last in-store event of the year. Very excited about this. Thursday the 27th, 5:30 p.m, we have Lindley Edmeads.
I'm very excited about this.
Yes, have you read The Hiding
Place? I have.
Yeah, me too.
I have.
Yes, very interesting book.
Absolutely. Can I say the word Truby King?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Plunkett come into it a great deal. And as a Plunkett baby myself, a mother who was very influenced by Truby King's teachings, I found it fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a lot more than that.
Yeah, and I think that's the hard thing when hand-selling this book to get across is that, it's sort of a memoir about a mother trying to raise her, you know, her young baby and sort of finding, you know, there's some difficulty there with feeding and sleeping. And then also it's sort of like a journal about being a mother and kind of getting back into work. But then also there are these segments from Truby King's work. At times it feels like lists of ideas for stories that the main character can't quite get to because of the demands of raising a child. There's a lot going on. My main criticism was, well, I could have read another 100 pages, you know.
It's very
enthralling, you know.
Yeah.
And it's been wonderfully bound and designed by Otago University Press. It's quite an attractive book, quite an interesting book. So if you can get your hands on that, Hiding Places, there's a couple of copies still in our shop. I loved it. I've put a staff review card in it. I'm currently judging the poetry entries for the Book Awards, so I'm not allowed to review poetry, you know, and have strong opinions in public about it at the moment. But fiction, on the other hand, you know, they can't stop me.
Open slather.
Yeah. And Lindley's going to be in conversation with Kieran Das of Word Christchurch. I think it'll be excellent. Yeah,
it will. Wonderful way to round off the year, Claudia, and thank you for and you and Scorpio for organising these events and bringing the writers to town and giving everybody the opportunity to see them, to listen to what they have to say, buy the books, and just enjoy the wonderful, you know, manaakitanga, is it, of Scorpio.
Thanks, Maureen.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Case Studies, A Story of Plant Travel, is not only an extraordinary collection of photographs, but a book full of thought-provoking essays and information. It was sparked by an image of a box of romantic English cottage flowers, fresh off a settler's ship, seen in the wild New Zealand bush. It was floral designer Felicity Jones who imagined this scenario and then engaged renowned photographer Mark Smith to help her recreate and explore this idea. I don't want to try and explain this project, Felicity, because it's quite, as I say, quite extraordinary. So welcome to both you and Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we need to start with the Wardian box to kind of explain the origins of this whole thing?
Well,
do you want to go first?
The project really started from a very personal viewpoint, just me kind of curious about how all the exotic plants came to New Zealand. And I couldn't find out how they actually came. So seeds obviously came, and that was easy. But gardeners will know a lot of plants propagate in other ways, vascular propagation. And I was just wondering how they came. And then eventually I discovered this very basic invention called the Wardian case. And that was really by mistake. Dr. Nathaniel Bagshaw Ward, who was a medical doctor in East London, but also a incredibly keen naturalist, and he picked up a pupae from a moth from his garden, and then put it under a glass dome just to see what would happen. And he noticed that when he picked up this little chrysalis, it had some dirt and a little branch on it. And he noticed that things started growing. And then, in fact, it lasted 3 years, all these little plants inside the glass dome without him doing anything. So he realised that could be a new way of moving plants around the world. So he persuaded some people, nursery men in London, to put some money in, and they started doing trials. And the first successful trip was to Australia, 6 months at sea, and all these plants were fine. So it was a wooden sort of crate with glass, and really they weren't. Well, there was a little bit of air that could get in, but otherwise they were the plants were left to their own devices, and they would. It was just a simple science of transpiration. So they would water themselves really throughout that time.
Left on the ship's deck.
And that case, which became known as named after Dr. Ward, known as the Wardian case, really transformed the world, and particularly for Aotearoa, because it was exactly the time that the big influx of European settlers. So all of a sudden, New Zealand. New Zealand's environment changed dramatically, because over the next 50 years there was just this huge influx of exotic plants.
It's one thing to know about that, Felicity, but it's another thing to, work out how you were going to show that in such a compelling way, the your original image of those British plants, garden plants.
Yes.
How to display it? When did you get Mark involved?
Well, I just had this. I love photography, and I love making things with botanical material and flowers and gardening. And I just had this idea of telling the stories. And it was actually that the film The Piano that I kept seeing in my head, of the dark sort of damp bush. And I kept visualising this case of sort of blousy cottage flowers, as if they'd just come off the boat, and they were going to be creating a garden that would remind the new settlers of their home. So, but I want them to be brilliant photographs. So that was when I always say I courted Mark for about a year before he actually agreed to get involved, and he agreed that we would do this first image that was kind of in my head. And when was that, Mark? Was it about 2018, 17?
2018. 2017, you asked me to do it. And then I think in 2018 we sort of finally did it, yeah.
What intrigued you, Mark? What was it about this whole project that got you hooked?
Well, I was very reluctant in the first instance, but I guess doing that first shot and then really understanding the bigger picture of the Wardian case. I mean, I have to say, I think plants are a fascinating thing, and I have always been fascinated by nature in one way, shape, form, or another. So when you throw that together with the story of the Wardian case, it just sort of kind of hooked me. And I think every project that we've done, you know, there was another door that opened. And I think, you know, Nicola described it as a fairly audacious, Nicola Leggett from Massey University Press, who sort of took the punt on us doing this, as an audacious project. And I think that first shoot where Felicity, you know, we lug stuff into the bush, and I'm thinking, what the heck are we doing with this? You know, and truly, it just shaped. It shaped up, and that was the start of it. Really, that is what hooked me.
Well, this project has taken you not just round New Zealand, but it's taken you back to England, to Kew Gardens, to the Natural History Museum, to universities. Because it was a two-way trade, wasn't it? Things came out, but plants went back. Yeah.
So that was
how Felicity got me on the second one, to be honest.
Oh, was it?
Because the first case that arrived with all of the plants for the garden, every case that arrived, one would leave with the native species of that country generally on the same ship. So if we had one, we had to have two. And the cover image is number two, actually, Warren.
Yes.
And so that came after number one. And that was definitely, that's when we both felt, well, there's something definitely here worth exploring.
Yes, because the cover image, people can't see it, this is a problem, isn't it, is native plants, and it's at Tehinga, I think, isn't it, Bethel's Beach?
Yes.
And fortuitously, a wave came in just as you were taking the shot.
Yes. Got two frames of that off, Warren. And then the water stayed away.
I call it fortuitously. I mean, it was almost, well, it wrecked the case and the glass smashed.
No. But then your imaginations, your looking into this, as I say, just as you see, and as you say, each shot led to another shot, to another shot, to another place, to another type of plant.
Absolutely.
And that's
And really, the book, I hope, the whole project really is us learning along the way, as well as, you know, so questions come up. And, you know, as I said, it started as a very personal thing, just thinking about my great grandparents, you know, gardening and you know how tough it must have been. But then, of course, as you go along, then you learn more about the, you know, colonial, the political and the social, and then the environmental. All the unintended consequences, and so it became a much bigger project, really.
Yes, because you've got gorse, you've got lupins, you've got pines.
That's right,
Mark.
And also, with the plants, also came European ideas around land management, which was very different. to how Maori see the world, Te Taio, and how we are all nature. We're all part of nature, rather than humans at the top imposing ourselves on nature. So that's been a big part of it as well.
Mark, what have been some of your most memorable shoots, would you say?
Well, I always did love number one and two, and they always came with a great challenge. But we always sort of, after one shot, we would think, well, what's our next plant that we'd like to look at? What's our next area that we'd like to look at? And we've always married the two together, and I think that's how the work sort of stands. It wasn't really designed or thought of that we would make a book originally. What we really thought was, after we're doing number one and number two, we thought we'd be able to then possibly work out a way that we could show them in an exhibition. And so we shot them in a very particular way. We shot them always 6.5 meters away from the case. Mm-hmm. And so it kept it as a sort of formal portrait. And that also gave us a way that we could present the works if we were going to show them in a gallery. When we went to England, we always wanted to look at the Kōwhai, which we'd done here in New Zealand. But the door had opened that we understood that Banks and Solander and Cook had pressed those plants. It's a very simplistic way of doing this, though, Morin. But those seeds that were pressed, or those plants that were pressed, produced seeds at the end. That those trees are now still alive in England. So there was a, you know, it's curiosity. We wanted to follow that through. You were sort of a circle of life, I suppose, in a funny way.
And Morin, just obviously the case is what kind of started us, but obviously then we were looking at other forms of plant travel, and obviously Banks and Solander, that was, you know, 50 or so years before the case was invented. So, but I think because Tuia 250 was happening, that we were inspired to look to earlier forms of travel, you know, to and from Aotearoa.
At what stage did you decide to include, I guess it was a book stage, to include the essays by people like Greg O'Brien and Dame Anne Salmond and all these various other wonderful people that you've got involved, Huhana Smith?
Well, I think but throughout the whole project, we have met so many amazing people and talked to so many people and learnt from other people in different from different areas of academia, or and I think when Massey Nicola approached us about the book, I think we always thought it would be great to get some words to sit alongside the images. And some different perspectives. Is that what you think, Mark?
Yeah, I think I'd love to think that the book, you know, the book was quite a an interesting bending of things to get it into a cohesive unit. I guess my sister calls it a difficult birth, perhaps a breach with a beautiful outcome, but. And I'd sort of think about the book now, and, you know, it's all been fairly fast and furious, but it's sort of quite a lovely, provocative thing, really. It's sort of, there's something for everyone within there, and I think you can delve into it as much or as little as you want, you know, whether it's just looking at the pictures or reading these words. And I think the people that have embraced the project were so generous, and I think that was what we sort of were struck with by academics and the likes. There was something that obviously touches everyone when it comes to plants and the stories that go with them. So yeah, it's knockout really, and how we've sort of, I don't want to say stumbled, but we've sort of, you know, we've moved from thing to thing or place to place, and always been, I don't know, it's been an amazing process, and it's really lovely to be able to give the whole project a home.
Well, it's a striking narrative as you go through, and you pull in all these different threads of you know, information to back up what the images are showing us. But it's a lovely way of one enhancing the other. I think one of my favourite stories in the book, in this lot, is of the primrose arriving in Melbourne in bloom.
That's right.
Tell us that.
And 4,000 people turned up at the dock, and they had to get the army in to control the crowds, all to see a little modest primrose flower blooming after 6 months at sea.
Yes, it just to me tells you everything about, as you say, people's need for nature to nurture them.
Absolutely. And just how powerful plants can be as a reminder of home or of, you know, memories of past lives.
Yes, and of course, Mark, you have a lovely image of a primrose in a Wardian box.
Well, that was with a snail that sort of snuck out of the bush that we didn't realise was there. A story that we thought, well, let's tackle it, you know. And so we, you know, Felicity got the plants, set it up in a little case. And, of course, our cases are not true Wardian cases, although they're still doing exactly the same, working on the same principle as what one that would have sat on a ship's deck did. And that was our work for the day, basically. And the little snail snuck out of the case and climbed up the glass whilst we were shooting.
Perfect.
And of course, that's also an example of what happened. Not just the plants, exotic plants, but they would have all the little insects and grubs that were being moved around the world at the same time.
Unexpected consequences.
That's right.
Well, I just have to thank you both for putting together this remarkable book. I've had such joy from looking at it and reading all the essays and all your captions. I just can't think of a better way to inform people and delight people. So thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Lauren.
The book is called Case Studies. It's by Felicity Jones and Mark Smith. And again, an absolutely stunning publication from Massey University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Dr. Jo Cribb is a management professional who specialises in the public sector focused on social justice issues, with roles leading work on domestic violence, on child poverty, and ultimately as the chief executive for the Ministry of Women. To find more balance for family and health, she switched careers to form a consultancy focusing on developing women leaders and management and governance capability within the non-government community sector. She now owns a vineyard. So a woman who knows what's important in life across all of that portfolio of experience. She joins me to talk about the book she's co-authored with David Glover called Don't Worry About the Robots, How to Survive and Thrive in the New World of Work. Tēnā koe, Jo. I hope you aren't being blown around too much there where you are.
Yeah, tēnā koe. It's fantastic to be here with you, Mary-Anne. And let's talk about the robots. They seem a bit safer than the Wellington weather at the moment.
Exactly. Well, here we are. Joe and I have been forced to do this entirely over Zoom. I'm not in the studio. So the robots are on our side. And as they have been through the whole of the COVID experience, in fact, my experience of COVID was hugely dominated by the technology turnaround that happened so quickly at that time. And that's a real theme for your book. Do you want to just use that as our intro?
Yes. So initially the book came out pre-COVID. It was a conversation between David Glover, who is, an amazing professional. He's had a background in advertising, marketing, education, and now he does a lot of consulting, particularly around iwi. And we had this conversation around particularly about the future of work. And at that stage, I had just stepped out of what people called my car park job. Like I had this chief executive job and had a car park. And apparently that's the marker of having made it. And I gave it up and I moved into this consulting, like this portfolio career. It's been nearly 9 years, and I can say it's the best decision I've ever made. But at the time, I knew it was going to be the right decision. And I had, when I announced my not renewing the contract and moving on, I literally had hundreds of emails, and even a colleague on a board took me out for coffee and said, "Is this kind of something midlifey? Do you know, have you gone a bit mad for this portfolio? You're giving away a great career." And it really started to, I also had to work out how to describe myself, because when you're a chief executive of an organization, it's easy. But when I'm on four boards and I'm doing some consultancy on this and I'm coaching this person, and your identity and your ability to explain what you're doing is very hard, right? And I used to just say, "I have a portfolio of interests," and people just look at you blankly to say, "What on earth does that mean?" Because it gives you no insights. And again, another insight is that the fascinating thing was that the first question we usually ask each other is, "What do you do?" And we're actually asking, "What do you do in your paid work?" And we're often using that to then kind of put people in boxes and understand how to relate to them. And when you kind of disrupt that by like having this portfolio thing that you can't, you have to take a bit of time to describe, and you don't really fit in a box anymore, or not an easy one. This whole concept of work and the future of it, which when we looked into the research, and I think is bearing out, is that actually we don't have a job for a life. We don't have a career for life. And a lot of us, particularly those people around my age, sort of midlife, have actually bought into the fact that, I've got this great job. I'm senior in my role, and it's going to be stable until perhaps sometime I retire. And for most of us, that's going to be a myth, because technology is going to disrupt that, and our concepts of what work look like are changing. And I think we're seeing that very much in our young people. They aren't in any way making the assumptions that you go to, you do your education, you go to work, and you retire. And I simply think this whole concept of retirement is even being disrupted, because we're probably going to have blended work and just rethink about it in different ways. So hence we wrote the book to say, basically for a lot of New Zealanders who are sitting there going, actually, it's just a straight run to whatever the end is. And actually all the research says that it's potentially not. And using the concept, we updated it last year, because when we first wrote it, there wasn't a thing called AI in 2019. And of course, in late 2023, this thing called ChatGPT started popping up. It's that recent, right? We're 18 months, and many of us now will engage with some sort of AI every minute of the day. Probably not
Google search. Every Google search, isn't it?
It wants to keep on summarizing my emails when I'm emailing my husband to get milk. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you can make that more eloquent, knock yourself out. So all the research potentially doesn't show that these AI tools are going to mean sort of the end of humanity or the end of work. But what they do mean is that the way we work is changing, and I think that we're already seeing that. And you won't lose your job potentially to a robot, but you will lose your job and your relevancy to somebody who has upskilled themselves in AI, who is using those tools to be more productive. So the book is a call to normal people. Normal people who aren't, I guess, software engineers and understand to try and really explain what AI is and what its potential is to do, and we just don't understand that. Nobody technical. And then we asked 14 amazing New Zealanders who are at the cutting edge of their industries, most of them at the cutting edge of technology, like the amazing Michelle Dickinson is right at the edge of it. And we said to them, like, you can see over the edge that perhaps we can't. What are you doing to prepare yourself to be relevant and thrive in the next decade? And what advice would you give to New Zealanders, knowing what you know about technology and how it will potentially impact how we work and even how we live? What advice would you give New Zealanders? So this is the book. It is the experts saying to us, here's how to be relevant, here's how to thrive in the next decade, given what is coming at us and will continue to come at us and will accelerate itself coming at us. That wasn't a very good sentence, but you know what I mean.
I do, Jo. I know exactly what you mean. And because, you know, that we're all experiencing that, the fact that it just keeps changing and it keeps changing faster. So I'm fascinated to hear about these experts that you chose, because they're an incredibly diverse group, and they're not necessarily all the people that you would expect to be talking with in terms of technology. Some of them are professionals in creative fields.
Yes.
There's an Indigenous people's leadership.
Yes.
So tell me about what diversity means to you and why it's so critical in this context.
Yes, and I do think while not all the people who are involved in the book are what I would call hard technologists, all of them have amazing insights about and are at the cutting edge of their fields. And some of the biggest disruption we're seeing in AI is in the creative fields, in terms of AI can now write poetry and make music and write whole books. And what does that then mean? Because it learnt off the books and the wisdom and the knowledge and the creativity of New Zealand, of actual humans, and is kind of, and my creatives would say, ripping them off. So I think there's a huge issue around there. Again, we've got Linda Clark, who is a prominent lawyer, who is very much thinking about the future of law and regulation. Again, how on earth do we regulate something that is so, I guess, uncontrolled potentially? And of course, the Indigenous perspective is incredibly important, given how much knowledge is held dear in Matarangi Māori and Indigenous. And what does that then mean for how AI would use that? And I think that's a really live debate. One of Rachel Patero, who's in the book, talks about AI as ancestral intelligence.
That's a
really interesting concept. And how does that then sit against AI as how we would know it as artificial? And so I do think they all have interesting, but the fascinating thing was when we interviewed them is that their responses to what was what they could see in terms of, I guess, the challenges and some would say, you know, the immense opportunities, is all of them said we have to become more human. We have to really double down on understanding what our personal values are, what we want for our families and what we want for our communities, and being really clear about that. Otherwise, we could have incredibly poor outcomes for ourselves. And that sense of really being perhaps clear about our values, I thought was that, you know, these are hardcore tech geeks starting to go, actually, humanity, we all need to know our values and we all need to be driving for what we think is a good life, because that's going to become even more important when so many opportunities and so much change comes at us. Mm. All of them pretty much said that. And I thought, what a fascinating insight. You look over the edge, you look at the issues, you look at the risks and the key pieces to just be more human. Isn't
be more human.
Yeah.
And be more human as a premise for getting on at yes. work in the workplace is, and you know, and thriving in your working life in a balanced way with the rest of your life. It's such a fundamental idea, isn't it? You know, I always used to talk about bringing my whole self to work, you know, as one of the things that really mattered to me about where I worked, you know, as somewhere where I could bring my whole self. And it seems like that's what the experts in your book are saying, that is going to make the difference, our ability to do that.
Yes.
And to be with each other like that. It's not just an individual doing that. It's creating workplaces that allow everybody to show up in that way.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And that sense of when the seas are rocky, and I think everyone is predicting that change will remain and driven, particularly by AI and how it is evolving, even how we think, how we learn, how we interact. I mean, people are now having relationships with AI in a way, and what is going to do to our fabric of our society. So that sense of the grounding of our communities and self is rocky. The way to sort of, if the seas are rocky, the way is to shore the boat, which means we're really clear about what matters to us, what a good life looks like, and what values we hold dear are the things that will steer us through. And they all coalesced around that concept of knowing where we want knowing what we want to be, knowing what a good life looks like, knowing what values we hold dear, and driving towards that means that we're more likely to be rocked around by change. We'll be more likely to be much more, take some discretion about what and how we use technology if we are really key and grounded in what a good life looks like.
Yeah. Okay, because this is a book about individuals navigating their own life and mm-hmm. their own working lives in a context that's constantly changing. It's not about a book about what we can anticipate from the AI, what's going to happen next, what thing we will see, what kind of what the robots will do next.
Yes.
Because
yes.
nobody can see that right no. at the moment. And so that was one thing I kind of felt like there is a whole chapter dedicated to AI and there's lots of interesting insights, and it's kind of like the meat at the heart of the book, but it's not what the whole book's about. But I thought it must be frightening going to print on that subject at the moment because it's changing so fast.
Yes, yes. But what we wanted to do was, for non-technical people, open the door a bit to what AI is. And, of course, neither David and I have technical backgrounds, so we did the research for potentially our friends and peers and colleagues to go, what on earth is this thing? I do have an inside running. My husband has a PhD in software engineering, so I do have an inside running because I live alongside this, so I could test it. But what I wanted to do is get my head on, what is this thing? Like, when I'm sitting there in ChatGPT and writing something in, what is it doing? And that is explained in the book. And it also explains, I think, for us, its limitations. It's basically trying to match, when you ask for something, it's trying to match whatever you have asked for with all its knowledge base, but it's also making assumptions and jumping. So if you ask for something that's red, if it finds something with red polka dots, it's probably going to give it to you. Mm-hmm. And so that you didn't ask for polka dots. So we need to understand it's how it works so that we can also understand it and also feel a bit less powerless too, because it is a machine. It is a program that is set up to operate in a certain way and do certain things. And once you start to know that, it starts to become, it demystifies, you know, what is happening behind our screens. And I think that's empowering. So I ask people not to flick through that chapter.
Oh, Joe, there's so much more that we could be talking about here. I wanted to get onto the matter of politics and AI and energy. There's so many things, but we're not going to get a chance to. So I've decided you need to write a new book. But this book, thank you very much for joining us. This book is called Don't Worry About the Robots. It's written by Joe Cribb and David Glover, and it's published by One Tree House. And if you are in mid-career and feeling intimidated by what's happening and the pace of change, get hold of this book and take hold of your future.
Absolutely. Get a cup of tea, sit down with it, and plan forward with a sense of, I don't know, power.
And optimism.
And optimism, yes.
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rath, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.